Welcome to The Complete Musician, creativity at its core, exploring innovative musical ideas, thoughts, and techniques for the modern musician in today's society, with your hosts, James Nagus and Drew Phillips.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Complete Musician Podcast. I'm James.
And I'm Drew.
And this is the podcast where we complete other people's music. You find your favorite unfinished symphony, and our job is to figure out how it ends. Thus, the complete musician. Is that right?
That's exactly what we do. We are doctors, and we are trained in the art of making things better by people who didn't have the time to finish it the first go round.
That's right. And yes. And also going back and fixing those problematic pieces like, you know, Brahms 1, Beethoven 9, all those real clunkers that people just can't stand to listen to.
They're really tragic in the way that they have so many mistakes, and we just have to go in and fix all of them.
Speaking of mistakes, our orchestra here just did a concert of all Prokofiev. So there were a whole lot of...
So famous mistakes.
Or a whole lot of notes that seemed like they could have been wrong ones, but nope, I guess not.
Wasn't it in our Halloween episode a while ago that you said that quote about we had like a pumpkin patch? It was Prokofiev's pumpkin patch. And you said every one in 10 pumpkins is a mistake or something.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. That was such a good one.
That was one of our first Halloween spooktaculars. If you haven't listened to that one, that has just some amazing commercials in it. You need to go listen.
In terms of time invested and quality of production, we put way too much time and effort into our holiday specials.
That was like 2018 or 2017. We've been doing this podcast for like 5 or 6 years now.
Well, every single week too. It's amazing. We have like at least 200 episodes. Right?
Exactly.
All right. Well, anyway, today's topic is music related, which is good because this is a music podcast.
Great.
And it's something that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and it's something I think we all think about, which is recitals. And I guess the larger context is just playing music for people. But I'll give a little context in why I've been thinking about this. So in a month or so, I'm giving another solo recital. Mm-hmm. And this one particularly is part of what they call our faculty artist series, which is just a slightly higher profile thing. It's a ticketed event. And there's usually a bigger audience and, you know, the kind of audience that typically goes to not every concert, but a handful. Like they'll select these.
Right.
And so these concerts tend to be traditional, I would say. Mm. Sometimes maybe just stuffy or not stuffy. I mean, my colleagues are great, but you know what I mean? Just your same old kind of recital where you
like
goes,
standard lit, like that's it. It's like nothing outlandish, nothing experimental.
Oftentimes. Okay. And I think something that we always think about is how to get audiences in the concert hall. And once they're in there, how do we connect? So the big topic is how do we connect with our audiences through our programming, through how we present ourselves. Because there was a quote that in Beyond Talent by Angela Beeching, she says that your product, your brand, is not what you produce, but it's the experience that people have with you. And that made a lot of sense to me once I started really thinking about it. And I think a lot of the things that we do are kind of geared towards that. Mm. You know, it's the connections we make. It's talking to people. It's engaging with people. It's why we go to workshops. It's because we're actually making a human connection. And it's a lot of what we do on social media as well. This is our brand. It's the experience that people have with us versus just a name. So when someone plays your piece, it's like, great, they're playing your music, but then there's talk about who you are, and people can reach out to you and ask questions, and if you come to clinics, like, so anyway. So I'm doing this recital, and I was trying to think of ways to engage with the audience. I'm doing just like up all of my miniatures, so all 27 miniatures.
Right.
And originally I was thinking you could do like a choose your own adventure kind of story where I could have them take their phones out and vote and which one do you want to do next kind of thing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
the more I thought about that, the more I thought there would be too much hassle. And then I don't know if this audience would be very keen on having their phones out.
Or receptive to that, yeah.
And it would be one of those things where the more they're kind of doing that, the less they're listening. So I know what I'm ended up deciding to do. I don't know if I told you what I decided on doing.
I don't think you did.
So instead, before I just tell you, let's brainstorm some other ideas of what okay. are some fun ways. Because, I mean, we can also talk about just the general things of, like, actually talking to your audience and giving oral program notes.
Right.
Which is just walking on stage, playing a piece, walking off stage, going home.
Well, and that's what we do. I mean, if you are listening to this podcast, you've probably seen us in person. You might not have seen an entire recital that we've done, although there is a digital one, but that's a little different.
The Columbus State one is up, though, in full.
Oh, okay. So you can absolutely see what we do, because when we perform, then we always give oral program notes every time. Mm-hmm. We don't go on and off stage between pieces, but we also are switching instruments every other piece.
True. Yeah. Right? But then, yeah, the oral program notes builds in that kind of rest time.
And I'd have to say that we also try and make it, I mean, humorous and relatable to a degree. And also, I mean, I remember specifically during your explanation of Sacred Secrets, I had an unplanned pantomime that went...
I do remember that now. Yeah. Right.
That was probably not something that had been seen at Columbus State that point, you know, to that point. So that'd be worth watching.
I'm going to have to go back and
I have to watch that.
Watch
okay.
what you did.
Anyway, yeah. that was an unplanned dramatic interpretation of the piece as you were explaining it, but we definitely address our audience and try to make them feel welcome. I think, don't we also ask them to sit close to the stage and not like way far back? I think we try and bring everyone forward. Sometimes it doesn't work very much, but we like to see their faces and talk directly to them.
Right. Yes.
So that's one thing.
And actually the first recital that we ever did as a quote unquote duo was at Iowa, and we cleared it. This was a performance hall that didn't have fixed chairs. It was all just like set up chairs. So we pushed all of those chairs to the back and then said people could either like bring blankets and come sit on the ground or like just grab a chair and just bring it forward.
And they ended up sitting on the floor. Like a lot of people sat on the floor, and that was cool. Oh man, you realize that was a decade ago.
Oh no.
That was 10 years ago. Yeah, that was our first Quarmodo recital. Yes. Even though it wasn't Quarmodo then, it was the beginnings of it.
True, pre-name.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I remember that. I think we moved the chairs out, or was it already like packed up? It was the end of the year.
No, we moved it.
We cleared the area
because if there were all these chairs set up, people would be inclined to, like myself included, probably sit in the back.
Yeah.
Because that's just what I do in
that's
classes
what I do
and in recitals. I sit pretty much as far back as I can.
Me too. I do the same. Oh man, that's so funny. Another thing that we do, for at least if we're thinking of relatability, is we perform most of the times when we can in jeans.
That's right. Yeah. So I guess we can just talk a little bit about this whole like wall between performer and audience, which is, it's not an actual wall. It's not a fourth wall, right? But it's this barrier of tradition and elitism, perhaps, if that's even a word that I said correctly.
Very much so.
That I think serves only to make audience feel disconnected.
And a performer
feel like more nervous too.
Yeah, more separate and more like there's a huge chasm between the, like you said, the elite of the person who you're supposed to be listening to and admiring, and then the audience who you must be quiet and you must be respectful and you must enjoy what you're listening to and pay rapt attention.
Now, as a sidebar, this is not to say that we advocate having a full-on conversation during someone's recital.
Right.
Because still, I'm sure you're the same way. If you're at a concert and someone's just whispering very loudly, as in like almost not whispering, it's one of those things that instantly makes your blood boil. It's like, could you please not do that?
Yeah.
So there is protocol in certain settings for sure.
Right.
But also, the more days I live on in this world, the less I really care about someone clapping after a movement between movements in a piece. If mm-hmm. they like it, if they're showing clap. Appreciation, we should be gracious and accept that appreciation.
I completely agree. As I have gone on in life, I have gotten, well, we've discussed this many times, I have gotten so away from the formality of performance mm-hmm. and how much of a, you know, and the environment of, you were right when you said stuffiness, it creates. I mean, think of the number of orchestras that have a what to do at the symphony page on their homepage, and how right. it says yeah. dress up, it says, or is a suggestion, dress up, don't clap between movements, all that kind of stuff. And it's like, really? Like, what? I mean, we're creating all these rules, and it's like, you, it's not enjoyable so much when you could just go and kind of live your life. I actually wanted to address the phone thing, because I now in my recitals, well, at my school where I give a faculty recital, we don't do physical programs anymore. I don't know Same. If you guys do it, but yeah. okay, so we do
so
QR
people
code.
Have their phones.
Yeah. Yeah, so they do QR code, so they're already looking at their phones. And I've actually made it a thing to where I say at the beginning when I welcome them, I say, look, you have your phones out, and you know, you're looking at a program, you may be reading program notes, you're looking at the title, fine. I actually make a point of saying, if you want to sit and scroll on your phone as you're listening to me play, okay. That's like, I think about now, how often do we watch TV, but we're scrolling on our phone at the same time? We're like, big screen play, but little screen give me joy. And
we scroll Doom scroll through. Makes me fill the void of sadness in my life.
And so I say, you know, if you want to scroll your social media, or if you want to finish an email, or you want to, I mean, do whatever, I'm going to play. Yeah. It's like, nice music. If you want to pay attention, like rapt attention, okay. And there will be some people who do that. But if you want to just like sit and enjoy yourself, like having nice background music on, I'll be the background music to your life for an hour. Okay. That's fine by me. It's hard, yeah. But it's hard to get away from that. You know, it's hard because there's an older generation who doesn't want to do that and thinks we should pay attention. So I think it's about finding the balance between the two.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, if I could freely, without any judgment, sit in the back of a concert and play solitaire and listen, I'd probably go to more concerts, to be honest, or to do emails and stuff. Like, right. you know, so.
And not feel like I'm being really rude.
Right, because that's how a lot of it would be perceived. There are, I believe, a couple of orchestras. I don't remember if it's Pittsburgh or one of those groups that it's doing some more casual style concerts where people can come and they don't need to be dressed up, and the programs are shorter and there's more engagement, and they can cheer and scream and do whatever. and I think that's really great, because I mean, people do that now with, you go to some video game concerts, or you go to anything that's related to like pop music or rock music when they're combining with orchestras or movies, and people are loud.
The familiar theme happens. Oh, gosh. How is it? How many times have we played the beginning of the Imperial March at a orchestra concert and the crowd screams because they recognize the beginning, right? Because they're excited. That happens all the time.
When I played a show as the backup band, it was orchestra, but it was with Grateful Dead.
Oh, man. I'm sure there was a lot.
The loudest part of the whole concert was the audience screaming and cheering. Louder than the orchestra, louder than the amped, you know, drum set and guitars. Yeah. It was the audience, because they were into it.
That's amazing.
Who are we to tell someone to like chill and calm down
Be
if they're
quiet.
Excited? Right?
Right.
Right. So, I don't know. It's kind of just an interesting thing to think about in terms of etiquette, contextual etiquette, and if you're a recital giver, whether you give someone permission to do that. Or another thing I was thinking when you're mentioning where I thought you were going to go when you're talking about at the beginning of your recital was, you'd say, I see you're on your phones looking at the program. I'm going to tell you about all of the pieces, so you can put that away. You don't need to look at the program. I thought that's what you were going to say.
Oh, and actually, I purposely don't do that. Whatever I write in the program notes, I actually give... I that's mostly, and I make it biographical of the composer and maybe the composer's notes. But if I'm going to play a recital, and maybe this is what you're about to talk about with what you're doing now with your recital, is that I give every bit of oral program notes I'll give is completely anecdotal. And it's it's completely experiential to my feelings. Like, I wouldn't write that in program notes, but I would, you know, like when I just gave a recital and I played Sacred Secrets, when I, to go back to that, I, in the program notes on the QR code that they scanned, gave your bio, and it gave, I think your program notes that you wrote, like why you wrote it, who you're commissioned by to
my
write
program
it, what
notes
for.
Are very skeletal and not very useful.
And I think I inserted the line about you based it on, you know, the story of the deity, the Norse goddess, and all this kind of stuff. But when I talked about it in the actual recital, I said, this is special to me because this was the last thing I played solo 3 years ago. This was, you know, I think I may have mentioned, like, I did a weird pantomime to it the last time we did it. I think it's gorgeous, and I have these, you know, I gave my own experience. So actually, that's what I do when I do program notes, is I make it way more personal because I don't list that stuff in the program.
Well, I think that's fantastic advice. And it's very similar to what I recommend my students to do when they're giving oral program notes, whether it's a piece they wrote or something else. You know, I ask them, so what are you going to say? And usually the answer is, I have no idea. So I'm like, okay, well, in my opinion, the audience is not going to care about, like, necessarily why it was written. They're not going to care too much about the composer unless they're a musicologist, right? They want to know what this means to you, why you picked it, what you get out of it, maybe what you want them to listen for.
Yeah,
but more, it's just, again, they're someone goes to a concert sometimes because they want to hear the piece of music, but usually because they want to hear the person or people playing it. So that's more important, is the rationale, is the you factor. In program notes. So
agreed.
So that's what we do when we do
that
these
is what
programs
we do.
And also because this is a lot more fun, and it's going back to the whole personal thing of kind of, it's a good detensioning, de-stressing thing, I think. Some people may get nervous talking in front of people, but I think it helps loosen you up.
I think it makes me feel more comfortable.
Yeah.
Every time. And it, especially if you're talking from the heart and you're talking about things that only you know, it's just like having a conversation. Much
and
easier.
As an audience member, if someone kind of, it's not that you have to pour your heart out, but if someone makes that personal connection, I am more invested. Also, as an audience member, in just cheering them on, like, you're going to go crush it. Like, I want you to play well because it's obviously important to you.
Agreed.
Which makes me think of, you know, we should do a whole program of pieces we hate, and we should tell the audience why we dislike this piece.
Oh, we could fill that program.
The question is, would we try to play the music really well, or would we also play it bad?
No, it'd be bad.
Yeah.
We'd have to play it badly. And you know what? I'd still go to that concert.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
I would still go to that. That'd be so good. Okay, let's divert. And, or, yeah, let's go to another place. So we've been talking about how to make them feel comfortable. What about musical selection?
Oh, okay.
How does that play into this?
So this is kind of a chicken or the egg type of question in some circumstances. Are you programming for yourself? Are you programming for your audience? Or are you considering your audience's experience kind of question?
Right, right. Because I know what we do, but what advice would you have for... Because we have a shtick, right? Like,
yes.
We play our own music.
And our music is generally acceptable.
It's acceptable.
Accessible to
some
audiences.
Things may not be acceptable. I don't know.
Right. So. Depends on how much you practice.
Some performances may not have been acceptable, but some I'm just kidding.
Right.
We've always been fun. And our music is, like you said, generally audience friendly.
Yeah.
And although I do think there are recitals now that have all of these different themes, and I mean, there's a lot, recent themes that we've seen is programs of all music by women composers, programs of people, of composers of color, programs of
newly
diversity.
And,
yeah, and or right. newly commissioned works, stuff that's... My last program I played, like I said, that last recital I did was all living composers and composers I know personally.
Mm-hmm.
That was really cool to me because I could talk anecdotally. And I could talk experientially about my experience knowing every single person. So that was really great. And I love doing that. Mm-hmm. But I do think themes are important. And you could still build a recital over the themes that you put into it.
Even more than thematic, I think it's the most important thing is just programming and playing with intention.
Mm.
Because in the same way that I could, if someone is passionate about, let's say, vacuum cleaners... I don't know, I'm trying to think of something that's so banal. If they're super passionate about vacuum cleaners, I will listen to them talk about vacuum cleaners because they're into it. And because of that, I'm into it, right? So not to discredit any of the thematic elements, but if you make a case for why you're playing this music, I think any audience can really get on board. If we, you know, help explain why, if it needs explanation necessarily.
Okay, so opinion... Or question for you, do you pick your students' recital literature?
I wish I didn't have to. I wish every student came in with a full list of pieces they really want to play.
I know, me too.
But I think a reality is that a lot of our students just don't know the rep as well, so that's why we have to help them with options. I'd like to give them, I mean, as many opportunities to either pick a piece or to tell me what kinds of pieces they like so that I can pick mm-hmm. pieces similar. Yeah. That's also just from a motivation factor for practicing.
Would you force a student to play something that, I hate the word force, but would you force them to play something that was good for them if they didn't particularly enjoy it?
That's a good question.
That's a hard question.
Subjectivity can change over time.
True. Like... Oh gosh,
there's
when
pieces
we have our...
I don't like, and then I end up liking them later once I understand how to approach it.
Well, I think especially like for us that we play a lot of new music, the old standards can get really stale after a mm-hmm. while. Even if they're nice, they can still get stale. So, like at this point in my life, do I ever want to program Strauss 1 on a recital? No, I've played it way too many times.
Sure,
but. For my students, when they do their gateway performances to, you know, keep moving on in music school, they're going to have to learn Strauss 1. That might be mm-hmm. a piece that they have to play. What if they don't particularly connect with it? Well, too bad. Like, it's just what you have to learn, you know, mm-hmm. or the Mozarts. Mm-hmm. You may not particularly love Mozart, but you still have to learn it.
And there's pieces that you can learn that you're not going to perform too.
Oh, totally. I mean, there's so many pieces, like the standards that I've learned but never performed, but that's, you know, a personal choice as well. And I honestly can't say that I've done recitals with pieces that I haven't loved. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think I've loved all of my music, and I guess I've just been really fortunate to have teachers who have let me do that.
Right.
So, but I know there are teachers who pick their recital rep for their students, and I think that's completely fine, but I do think that's a hard line to walk, and have to be cautious with it, because you're right, playing with intention is so important, and I'd much rather, I think a recital is, although there is no data for it, I would say that a recital that has music filled, by someone who enjoys it is better played and more enjoyable to listen to by the performer and the audience member.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any data to support that. I don't think there could be, but I think it's just, we all know that's true.
Yeah. And there's something too, also just with someone who's deciding to go to a program, if they look at what your program is and they see variety or things they don't know or some they do know and kind of a mixture that can determine whether they come. I'll give you a perfect example of that, which is, I know you'll love this. So at our Performing Arts Center, coming up very soon, we have Hilary Hahn coming and playing a recital.
Awesome.
Who is one of the best violinists alive
in the
today,
world.
Right?
Yeah. Awesome.
Her program is three pieces, and they're all Bach.
Were they written for violin?
Yeah, I believe so.
Well, then... You know,
I know you like your transcriptions. I don't remember exactly, but it's
box transcriptions are not my thing. But
it's all box. So yeah, I look at that and I go, I don't know if I want to listen to that.
Like, that's just yeah. That's.
But if there's anyone that would make me like it, it's probably her playing.
Oh, she's gonna play it fantastically. It's just that's such a one-sided program, and there's value in it. 100%, and you know she's gonna nail it, and it will be beautiful. But do you want to listen to that much Bach in one sitting?
Right. And I'm curious to see. Well, I actually don't have tickets. I think they were probably sold out a long time ago.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to see what her approach was in terms of if she engages with the audience or what kind of program notes are in that program. And
I've never seen her live, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of touring soloists, of course, they have like the types of music that they play, and like some, you know. Soloists, they have like a piece that they go and do everywhere, and that makes sense pragmatically. I understand why someone would choose repertoire of that sort, but also you could, someone of that skill level could literally do anything,
right?
So really there has to be some really intent behind the Bach, which then brings me back to my point that I made before. If someone has a lot of, if they're really into it, I'll listen to it. So I have this kind of contradictory thought process going on.
Interesting.
Yeah. But if it was like the Barber and the Corn Gold, I would
go immediately.
There
that would be instantly. That's beautiful. Her
because
playing
that's
on that is
subjectively
gorgeous.
Just music I like.
It really is. So thinking about the music picked for recitals, I like when you said that if you are able to pick the music that you're going to perform, definitely make sure it's with intention. Whether that intention is that you love it, which will make the audience love it most likely, whether it's that the audience love it. I mean, I think there's certainly pieces out there that are maybe higher level, difficult pieces that you're like, well, the experience for the audience is really cool, but is this like the most fun to play? Maybe not. Maybe it's like really taxing and really challenging and you really have to focus and concentrate and you can't soak it in like you would an audience member because you're the one doing it. I mean, there's certainly those pieces out there. Or if it's the intention of, I need to play this, so I'm going to do it. Right? One of my recitals in my master's, I think the year before you came, I gave a recital of all literature written for low horn because I wanted to work on my low horn playing chops.
Nice.
And so it was like Bagatelle and like Haydn 2 and like all of these things. Would I necessarily now program any of those? They're fun, I guess. But there's a whole lot more pieces that I like better.
Right.
So I knew I just needed to do it. And so that was the intention.
And there's also a big difference too for, I felt once I graduated, once I wasn't a student and being adjudicated on my performances,
so many doors opened up.
Yeah. So you could play just because you wanted to. And there's a lot of freedom and joy that comes with that. 100%. And so it's hard. And that's why I think we both try to empower our students to have variety and, you know, have their say in the programming of their recitals to try to simulate that. But it is a balance for sure.
Yeah. So what are you doing with your recital?
Okay. What would you want me to do? What would you, as an audience member, want me to do with my miniatures?
I see. I really enjoyed the fact that you said you were going to make them pick them. That was my favorite. I think we've done a poll in an audience before. Remember? We did that in a recital once.
Hold on. To kind of go behind the curtain here.
Oh, no.
We did a poll, but we actually... No. Okay, I won't spoil it.
Okay, you can guess where that's going. What do I want you to do?
It was maybe a bias poll.
The answer may have been decided already. So you have all of your miniatures.
Yes.
Okay, how many of you are going to play?
All 27.
You're going to play all 27? Okay. Yes. how could you make that interactive with the audience? I like the idea of a poll. I mean, the best thing I could think of or something fun that would be thought of is like you list all of the titles but none of what they sound like as like a PowerPoint or something behind you and then they find some way to weigh in on how they should be organized into the sets.
And we haven't talked about this, have we?
No.
Because you're actually very close to
haven't. That's deciding. That's kind of what I thought you might be doing anyway. Like, and that's when you said that you were going to let the audience pick. I didn't know you were going to play all of them. I thought you were going to have all of them available. And then you're like, I'm going to play the ones that you pick.
Yeah. I mean, so my original plan was something that actually Travis Bennett did when he did a bunch of miniatures, which was let audience vote at a certain point, at certain junctures. Which piece, A or B, or I wasn't there, so I didn't see exactly how he did it, but there was a certain element of choice, choose your own adventure kind of thing that required, it was an online-based platform. They get to log in and vote. Originally, I wanted to do something like that, but it would require setting up a projector, a computer, a screen, having people on their phones, which again, the audience for this recital may not be privy to be on their phones or even have smartphones, to be honest.
Yeah.
So instead, what I'm doing is for each, and I thought about putting all 27 titles just out there, but I thought I'd give people a fighting chance. So for each piece, I'm listing the titles in alphabetical order, and then underneath that, just one with a line, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine with lines. Yeah. So as I'm playing, they can pick which of the, in this case, like the nine miniatures, which of those nine titles they felt the music represented, and or they can write their own title. And so then after every piece, then I'll go through and I'll tell them each title, and then I'll go on to the next set of miniatures.
I like that you're letting them title the piece themselves, and provided the word, but that'd be cool. And to you could even be more creative and go further at some point and just let them make up their own title.
Exactly. So if they don't find one that adequately fits, I mean, it's not that they're going to necessarily have the ability to share their titles. I was thinking about getting feedback, but then that gets just a little tricky.
Didn't do it on social media and use a hashtag. Create one and make them post their thing and put a hashtag on it. And then you see it later. That actually would be pretty cool on Instagram or something. That reminds me of something that I think would be a great idea. A couple of years ago, my orchestra did pictures. And before we did the pictures, there was an elementary school that we went to. We got like the kindergarten or first grade class to draw pictures based on each movement that they heard. And we displayed all of those at the concert. And I think there was a projector going behind showing the pictures of each movement. Some were seriously disturbing. Like Baba Yaga was pretty disturbing.
I can imagine for
the children, because they didn't say it was the hood on Fowl's legs. They just, I'm pretty sure they just said Baba Yaga, and whatever the kids thought a Baba Yaga was.
I would draw the little like Grogu, like the little baby Yoda. That's what comes to my mind.
Some like squat creature of filth is what comes to my mind. Anyway, but they did that. That was really cool. But I thought what would be really neat is if they had the kids there drawing as they were listening. I think that would be really cool, although a little distracting because kids are kids and like there's crayons and colored pencils and I'm sure they'd be loud, but at this point who cares? You've heard pictures a million times.
We did with one orchestra I played with in Florida, there was a traditional concert where I don't know if they did it every year, but they would be playing a piece and then they'd have a local artist who would paint on stage while the piece was being played.
That's awesome.
However, I can almost guarantee that the picture was, you know, imagined and already like practiced. And so it was just recreating in live time rather than just going from pure inspiration or what the orchestra was doing.
Yeah.
So, but the concept is still really interesting for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, that's kind of cool. I just thought that'd be a really good idea. But I like the way you're doing that. That's really creative. I like it.
So, I mean, there's
more
so
interactive than just sitting and listening and being told.
That's what I'm hoping for. And I'm hoping just for something just a little bit more memorable and just making the audience feel valued and not necessarily like seen or heard, but just I acknowledge that they're there and I'm thankful they're there. And let's just have some fun, you know?
Do something different.
Because these pieces, these miniatures are not serious.
Right.
Like, there's a couple sad ones, but it's all in general just lighthearted fun.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of other concerts too, like our Brass Quintet concert. We did a thing where there was a narration written for, it was the Bozzo Sonatine, and there was a story written, and it was narrated. We added narration over top, and then there was some visuals. Cool. I mean, there's so many ways. I had a grad student that did Glier. Actually, his whole recital, he engaged with the art school and had student artworks displayed that kind of represented or were similar to the pieces he was playing. And cool. I mean, so many levels of interactivity that I think we can consider in our performance.
Yeah, that's more memorable. That's more fun to do. And the audience remembers it too. I actually, in a recital I did in my master's, it may have been that one I was just talking about, I played, I played Jeff a Girl's Romp. And you know the part where you're supposed to pop on the mouthpiece?
Yep.
Well, I thought that was hokey, and I didn't like it. And I told him, like, I don't want to do that. I said, during the recital, I'm going to clap twice and then make the audience do the wave.
Didn't you have him scream?
I did. Yeah. And it's on the recording. It's fantastic. I like, clap, and then I point at the whole audience, and they scream and do the wave in the middle of the piece. It's, like, my favorite. Jeff loved it.
Yeah. It makes me think of improv stuff, too, where I don't know if we ever did this on one of our recitals, but next time, let's absolutely do it, where we'll give, like, three kind of conduction things, where one is applause, two is cheer, and three is boo. And so we can make the audience boo at us, and that's hilarious.
Love that.
Okay, especially we're doing if it. One tells a bad joke or something like that.
Oh, we're doing Ooh. It. Oh, we're doing it. Oh, okay. Yeah, new thing. But anyway, so I guess what we're saying is, when it comes to your recitals, that I like the programming with intention, being, I think nowadays, especially for getting people in, make it memorable. Make it accessible and relatable and memorable. And honestly, we'll continue to draw in crowds. Maybe that doesn't mean bringing a cannon and a beach ball, but maybe it means that you invent creative ideas like what you're doing that can be interactive to the audience and can get them involved more than just a stuffy, you know, concert of old where it feels like you're being disrespectful for just pulling out your phone when you get an email.
Right. Yeah. It's the experience that people have with you. That's Agreed. What matters.
Agreed.
And that's what's going to do it for this episode. So we appreciate you listening as always. We'd love to hear any interesting creative recital ideas that you have. So feel free to in contact with us on the social medias.
The social medias.
Or he said as he was got up from his rocking chair. And coremotohorn@gmail.com is our email there. And we would love to know what you'd like us to talk about in future episodes. So reach out.
Yeah, so thanks for being with us today, and we'll be back with you soon. Bye.